outside, 6 to 8 for Radio Santa Cruz, 9.3 FM. Got lots of interviews, and the report on today's hearing for the right of three of us to return to City Hall to peacefully petition for an end to the sleeping ban. The response was thumbs down. Details to follow.
Rosenberg's H-bomb, Sugar Ray, Panmunjom, John Randall, the King and I, and the catcher in the right. Eisenhower vaccine, England's got a new queen. Marciano, Liberace, Santayana, goodbye.
We didn't start the fire. It was always burning since the world's been turning. We didn't start the fire. No, we didn't light it, but we tried to fight it.
Joseph Stalin, Alan Carr, Nasser and Prokofiev, Rockefeller, Campanella, communist bloc. Roy Cohn, one for all, Toscanini, Dacron, Gin, Gin, Foo Falls, rock around the clock. Einstein, James Dean, Brooklyn's got a winning team. Davy Crockett, Peter Pan, Elvis Presley, Disneyland, Bardo, Budapest, Alabama, Khrushchev, Princess Grace, Peyton Grace, trouble in the Suez.
We didn't start the fire. It was always burning since the world's been turning. We didn't start the fire. No, we didn't.
Spears Broadsides, Civil Rights on the Streets, in the Suites, and all around the town. I'm your host, Bathrop Spear Robert Norse, and hold on to your hats and pick up your telephone. It's 2 hours of what's going on out there. You call in and you tell us, you tell the community what's happening in the city of Santa Cruz. 427-3772 is the call-in line, 427-3772. And the lines are open should anyone want to call in. Main things we focus on this show are civil rights for folks who are not as rich as they might be. And today in court, we have a defeat, but not an unexpected one, and not one that's the end of the story. Three of us, myself, Becky Johnson, and Bernard Klitzner, the so-called Coffee Klatch Three, went to court to try to stop the mayor's office, through the person of Anna Brooks, from its freeze-out of protesters in the city council offices. That's the building right next to the city council chambers. It houses the office of every city council member, the city manager, and the mayor, no doubt as well as a few other staff members, and the city manager and assistant city manager as well. A lot of records are kept there for 3.5 weeks. Some of you regular listeners may remember the city council tag team teach-in and coffee clutch. Spent about 4 hours a day waiting in the public foyer to talk to council members to try to put the sleeping ban repeal on the city council agenda. As the weather got colder, as the new council members came into office and were supposedly going to fulfill their commitments, and of course haven't done that yet, or haven't done that period, I think they've broken their commitments by not having acted, and this being February already. I think that the kind of misery and suffering that has been caused, that continues, is a profound betrayal. And about 20 people at various times, no more than two or three at a time at the most, were in those offices, usually sitting reading a magazine with a sign and the sleeping ban and waiting to talk to council members when they came through, and sometimes actually getting the ear of a council member and a dialogue with that person for a while and engaging in some discussion back and forth on the issue of the sleeping ban, and generally putting the city council on notice that the public has not forgotten that Santa Cruz is the city that makes sleeping outside after 11 o'clock a $54 crime, that makes covering up with blankets a $54 crime, the city that has 160 place for 160 people at night, actually 158, out of the hundreds and hundreds, dare we say 1,500 to 2,000, 1,000 to 2,000, anyway, more than 1,000 homeless people, many, many homeless people in Santa Cruz who face a criminal status through no fault of their own for simply falling asleep, so that the folks who don't want them around give the police a tool to make them disappear in a completely unconstitutional fashion. That's what we were trying to get City Council to deal with. That's what they so far have refused adamantly to deal with. Get them to deal with it. Call them, 420-5017. That's the cold line for City Council. Not the hot line, because they aren't doing shit about things, but the cold line. You dial into the morgue. But you got to dial into the morgue. You got to go into hell. You got to keep raising these issues before the City Council, preferably with as little energy as you can, because there's lots of better things to be spent with your energy. But do spend a little energy calling the City Council tonight, 420-5017. Tell them it's time to end the sleeping ban, or what else do you propose? Thank you very much for homeless people who are outside, at least having to sleep tonight and the next night and the night thereafter. Anyway, we went to court because in order to stop us from going into the City Council offices, Anna Brooks, administrative assistant to Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice, through the city attorney, the city police, got an injunction against the three of us, claiming that we were harassing her by doing such things as asking for change for records with a $20 bill, pilfering pens, interrupting conversations, speaking in a loud tone of voice, and recording the proceedings, tape recording the proceedings. We had good reasons to tape record the proceedings when Mayor Fitzmaurice began telling the people who were there in the public area they could not be there. He wanted them gone and, in essence, threatening them. Police would not take complaints about Fitzmaurice's illegal threats. Instead, they used a restraining order to get rid of us. A legal tool, or actually an illegal legal tool. And we fought back. We went to court on January 11th, got a court date which was postponed somewhat, and went back to court today on February 8th. Today, the issue in court was the question of, is the Anna Brooks lawsuit a slap suit, a strategic lawsuit against public participation? That is to say, is it a lawsuit that is designed to intimidate the public from exercising their basic constitutional rights? And to tie them up in court. So instead of spending our time organizing around the sleeping ban, we're fighting this business in court so we can get back to City Council to engage in normal activities, however futile those activities may be. It is our right as citizens to try to do that. And when we start getting cut off, believe me, you guys and you women out there also get cut off, because if they can do it to us, they can do it to you. Well, the issue, as I said, today before the court was not even is there any evidence that justifies Anna Brooks's peculiar claims of harassment, which we believe were motivated by Tim Fitzmaurice, a mayor, or Emperor Fitzmaurice, as some like to call him, Emperor Fitzmaurice's concerns about wanting us gone, regardless of our right to be there. But rather, we asked that suit immediately be struck because of the fact that there was a real constitutional issue involved in the First Amendment, and that her suit had no merit from the word go. In other words, before you even look at the evidence, you have to look at the kinds of behavior she's objecting to and the kinds of rights that those of us who are in that public area have. And I think to any reasonable person, and unfortunately Judge Kathleen Akau was not a reasonable person here, more like a crony of the folks in city government. I'm afraid that's what I tend to explain today's decision. Although there was absolutely no evidence against, certainly no evidence at all against Bernard Klitzner. The evidence they had against him was he said to two people as they came in the door, "Did you sleep well last night?" Or, "How did you sleep last night?" If that's the basis for excluding someone from the City Council offices, we are in big trouble. Generally speaking, I'm going to play for you now David Beauvais, attorney from Berkeley, his opening arguments on this issue, and you're going to hear some of the remarks of City Attorney John Barisone, who is taking the case that we should be excluded. What was decided today was not, we actually, the real decision about whether this injunction should become a permanent 3-year injunction, which is what they're looking for, will be decided at an evidentiary hearing about a month and a half down the road, or perhaps the decision will start there, because we're now going to go into discovery phase, and we're going to demand documents showing any correspondence between Anna Brooks and the city manager, the mayor, the police department, and other officials, which might indicate that it wasn't her that initiated this whole thing, and also with her union and the normal processes that she would use to get grievances through and so forth. I personally think However sincere Anna may be in feeling uncomfortable with having us in the city council offices, that goes with the territory. You are secretary to the mayor. You have to deal with a wide variety of people. And one of her responsibilities was to deal with us. And I think that, as I said, this was a politically motivated situation. Now let's hear what how it went in court today. As I said, we lost this round, but I think it was pretty much we were pretty much doomed as we walked in, because I believe Superior Judge Akau was prepared, in essence, to sort of read off the laundry list that City Attorney John Barisoni had given her, without considering in any meaningful way the kinds of arguments that we presented. Although she kept acknowledging, "Well, you have a constitutionally protected right to be there," you know. But then, of course, we don't, because she continued the injunction. And the fact of the matter is that though we were engaging in constitutionally protected activities, which is an absolute bar in a harassment lawsuit, you can't sue someone for harassment if they're engaging in constitutionally protected activities. So if for example, it might be illegal for you to demand to be in contact with a city official at his or her home, you can demand to have contact with a city official in a public place or through the public city hall process. That is a situation where you have the right to do that, because it's a constitutionally protected First Amendment activity. The judge admitted, you have a right, you know, what we were doing was constitutionally protected, but we were still harassing. I mean, it's a strange decision. And again, we haven't considered the evidence particularly. She just looked at some of the preliminary declarations. But let's hear some of the arguments.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you very much. Your Honor, I'm going to go straight to the issue of the requirement that the plaintiff show the probability of prevailing on the merits. And I do think that the court is to consider all the declarations in determining whether or not she can make a case. And I'm particularly concerned in this case about the vagueness of many of her allegations. I think the court has to pay particular attention to that. For example, if someone complains that someone else is talking loudly, it becomes a question of degree. How long was it? Does it happen every day? We don't get a sense of that from her declaration or from any of the other declarations, that was conduct that persisted for such a long period of time that it would constitute harassment. Nor is it clear that the defendants were ever asked to keep quiet or mute their voices. So normally in a situation like that, if a person's confronted with that kind of situation, they would ask the other person to speak in a lower tone of voice or not speak as loud. That's the normal reaction. It's not to run down to the court and get a restraining order. And I think that's what is a bit unusual about what's happened in this case. So the lack of any specificity with respect to the allegations is very troublesome. And we have contrary declarations from the defendants, which I think address those questions much more specifically than Ms. Brooks does or any of the other declarations that were filed on her behalf. I would also ask the court to keep in mind, because I think it's a very significant fact or a very significant feature of this statute, and that is that the allegations have to be shown by clear and convincing evidence. And that's a much higher standard than applies, for example, if you were seeking an injunction under this section for violence or threat of violence. And when we couple that burden with the vagueness and conclusory statements that Ms. Brooks makes in her declarations and that the others make in their declarations, this case doesn't rise to the level of clear and convincing evidence of harassment. Coupled with the fact that the defendants were engaged in constitutionally protected activity. They were engaged in classic petitioning their government. This is a place that is appropriate for that purpose. They did not do this in a way that was unreasonable. They didn't come as a horde of people to occupy a small area. They kept the numbers down to one or two most of the time. They kept it down for far less than the entire business day. So it wasn't a situation where they came in at 8 and left at 5. So this was a very tempered kind of approach. And as Mr. North points out in his declaration, this actual way of proceeding had actually been done before in that office. And it actually resulted in an item being put on the agenda as a result of that effort. So it had a success as an outcome. And because it was successful before, it's being tried again. And the urgency of it was the fact that we've had 41 or 42 people die in Santa Cruz in the last year who were homeless and died, at least some of them died in part, to not being able to bundle up and protect themselves at night. So it's an issue that is burning for a resolution. It's an issue that the council needs to address. It's an issue that the defendants are very fervent about prevailing upon their city officials to take some action. And they did it in a reasonable way, in a way that the Constitution says it's appropriate to do it. And in a place that really couldn't do it any other place. I mean, you can't go to city council and do it this way. You can't get that interaction at the city council. You can speak for 3 minutes in public. If you're not one of the defendants, you can. But, you know, if you want to talk or lobby, you have to do that outside of that setting. Because it's it's not meant for that. So this was very appropriate behavior. And I'm very concerned because Ms. Brooks does not really tell us what her emotional distress was. She says that she was distressed. And there was Ms. Brooks, at one point, when Becky Johnson was there, Becky Johnson thought she was calling the police, but she wasn't, apparently, because they never came. And so it wasn't a case where she actually called the police.
She asked for
Unfortunately, you can't hear responding here.
Well, but it has to be reasonable. That's the point. Under the statute, it has to be a reasonable concern for her safety. This is not based upon the subjective feelings of a particularly susceptible individual. And so we have to look at what a reasonable person would have thought. And up to that point, what reasonable person would have considered Becky Johnson to be a danger?
Attorney's arguments, and you'll be able to hear John Barrasoni's arguments. You'll get some drift as to what's going on here. The judge is fundamentally rubber stamping the city attorney's case and ignoring the issues that the attorney for the Coffee Clatch 3, the two attorneys are raising.
It might step over that line if it were happening constantly. But Ms. Brooks doesn't tell us that. For all we know from her declaration, that happened once. And maybe it happened twice in a period of 4 or 5 weeks. Now, would the court say, well, that's harassment because you were interrupting her twice in 4 weeks that you were in the office? I don't think the court would reach that conclusion. And she's got the burden here of showing that she's likely to prevail on the merits. So she has to come forward with specific information. And if she was intending to come to court to seek redress, one would think that she would have the facts in order in her declaration, specifying that on a particular date at this time this thing happened, and with some specificity as to what it was. People frequently, you know, cut each other off. It's not the height of decorum to do it, but it's just part of human intercourse and interaction. It doesn't constitute harassment to do that. And when we talk about what serious emotional distress is, or substantial emotional distress, it's the same standard that's used in the tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress. And this requires a showing of, it requires conduct which entails such intense, enduring, and non-trivial emotional distress that no reasonable person in a civilized society should be expected to endure it. That's the standard that we're talking about. And that has to be shown by clear and convincing evidence. And that's not, this case doesn't measure up to that. I will grant you that a person in Ms. Brooks' position might be uncomfortable about the presence of the defendants in her office. There may be some level of discomfort. And the First Amendment is clear that because you're uncomfortable, with someone's message or someone being there to remind you about an issue, that that doesn't allow that the persons be banned from that forum or that place to express that point just because it makes people uncomfortable. And that's really what this case is about. It's about her feeling uncomfortable. That's about the best you could say about it. She's almost candid about that in her declaration when she says that your mere presence bothered her. She said that. That was her opening statement in her declaration. And then she went on with these emendations of other things that she claims occurred. For example, someone may have inadvertently walked off with a pen. Mr. Norse tenders a $20 bill for a small copy job. These kinds of things that are really everyday matters that people just endure. Any attorney who goes to the clerk's office is going to endure some of that kind of thing, you know, where they have to deal with dotting I's and crossing T's and so forth. So life is full of that sort of thing. This is no different. And this is not a situation where she has shown any kind of emotional damage impact from what has occurred here. And I think in light of the First Amendment issues, we have to seriously look at how compelling these allegations are in light of what the defendants were attempting to advance. They were engaged in petitioning their government in a classic way. And this is not a sit-in of sorts, Your Honor. This was not a sit-in. There was no civil disobedience. There was no statement, we're going to sit here until you give us what we want. We're not going to leave the office. Right. And they didn't interfere with the public's use of the office. There were three chairs there. There were usually one or two people there. You know, there's no citizens complained that they denied access to the office because they were there. And as far as the continuous tape recording is concerned, I think we made it clear in our declarations that that occurred after the mayor came out and tried to intimidate the defendants into leaving the office and was accusing them of speaking too loudly when in fact they weren't. And at that point, they felt that it was necessary to make a record of what was happening because they anticipated that allegations might be made and they wanted to be able to show that nothing untoward had occurred. So the continuous tape recording did not constitute harassment. It was a legitimate purpose to protect the defendants from accusations that might be made in the future. And that's why that was done. As far as the videotaping, it was the same thing. Ms. Brooks wanted to make sure that Becky Johnson left that office precisely at noon, or certainly not one nanosecond after noon. And because Ms. Brooks was very testy on this issue, Ms. Johnson wanted to document the fact that she had left the office on time and was photographing or videotaping toward the office door when Anna Brooks stepped out. And Anna Brooks misconstrued that situation as some kind of invasion of her privacy, which it was nothing of the sort. And that's explained in detail in Ms. Johnson's declaration. So I think we have vague, conclusory allegations subject to a clear and convincing standard of proof in a case that implicates the First Amendment in a public place, in a public office. And where you balance the interests here is to say that the First Amendment has to be given a great deal of room to breathe. That Ms. Brooks, as a person who has interactions with the public on a daily basis, given her role and her position, has to be at least somewhat able to cope with these kinds of interactions. I imagine that people will walk into that office and be unhappy about a lot of things, you know, maybe their tax bill or maybe a permit that they were seeking or whatever else. Routine city business goes on there. You're going to have people who come in there in a variety of moods, behaviors. And I don't see any behavior here that justifies issuance of an order of a TRO. It just doesn't meet up to the standard of 527.6, which itself is very sensitive to the constitutional issues involved. And I want to finally add, having said that, that insofar as Bernard Kouchner is concerned, there are no allegations against him. I don't even know why he's here.
Bernard is involved because he said to people coming in on two occasions,
that question.
Did you sleep at night?
I'd love to see how that asking a question of that sort would constitute harassment of Donald Brooks or anybody.
I'd like to bring up the chilling effect that this has had on other activities. And I think that's a really crucial part of the constitutional activity, that we have declarations that other people have been, by taking this action, there were many actions that the plaintiff could have taken short of a restraining order. They could have made some rules that no one could stay in the office. No one could stay in the office more than a half hour. Have posted a sign saying that. They could have, you know, instead of singling out this situation the effect has been that other people have been chilled from coming in to try to petition the mayor and the council members on these issues. And I think that's the result of the going straight to a restraining order without taking any steps in between, any of the minor steps that they could have taken in between to have lowered the level, if any, of the activities. I think that one of the things that also another thing that the TRO was issued ex parte in this case, and I believe, and Mr. Beauvais probably knows better about this issue and that you address that, but that's not apropos.
Right. The U.S. Supreme Court, in the case of Carroll versus Princess Anne at 393 U.S. 175, 1968 case, held that ex parte restraining orders on constitutional activity issued without notice, or when the defendants can be found, results in a void order, that you have to give notice if you can in those situations. All three of the defendants were able to be given notice, obviously because they were still going to the office. They could have been given notice there, and they were in fact readily served with the copy of the TRO after it was issued. So the initial issuance was void under U.S. Supreme Court precedent. It really constitutes a prior restraint. That's the kind of logic that the U.S. Supreme Court uses to justify that. So,
and what Attorney Beauvais is saying there is that because this is a free speech issue, you can't just go in and say, oh, Anna Brooks alleges harassment, therefore you guys are enjoined from going to City Hall until 2 weeks down the road when you can have a hearing. Rather, you get called to a hearing first. There has to be a showing made. You get a right to answer, and then such an order could issue. That's not what the city attorney, Anna Brooks, Mayor Fitzmaurice, and Judge Samuel Stevens, who originally did this order, did in the first instance. You're listening to proceedings today from the hearing of the Coffee Klatch 3 in Department 6 of Catherine Acow, who turned out to be a bad choice for a judge, though it's arguable that any judge would have essentially sided with City Hall on this issue. I have in the studio with me court watcher and city council watcher Scott Graham. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Robert.
Let me put on your mic.
That
again.
That might help a little bit.
Mics are good.
Yeah.
I apologize to the audience for not having Catherine Acow. She was somewhat amplified, but not amplified enough, and we couldn't really place the microphone closer to her without making it obtrusive, as she might put it. That was her claim, that we had to be in the city council offices unobtrusively, or somehow it was we were fit material to be restrained by restraining order if one of the secretaries didn't like us there, and that's what happened. Scott, any you've been following our situation, the sleeping ban, city council's response to the attempt to get homeless people rights, as well as this court case for a while, and you were in the courtroom twice today. You came at 8:30 in the morning when we were kind of, we trooped over to Judge Attic's court, and then the attorneys disqualified Attic based upon the concerns of the three of us that Attic has been pretty hard line around the Steve Argue case, where Steve Argue, an activist, was defending a woman and punched a police officer. And I guess Attic didn't allow a lot of evidence in that showed bias by this police officer and so forth. And also Attic's behavior in the Gutierrez case, the daughter of Maria Gutierrez, a figure in the Beach Flats who's been the former manager of the Dolphin Apartments and an activist to stop the bulldozing of the Beach Flats for a long time. Her son was sent away to prison based on arguably preposterous rulings by Judge Attic. On the other hand, we got Judge Acow, who was simply doing all she could to simply endorse the city attorney's case. I mean, you brought up something a moment ago. I think you were saying something about where's the evidence of harassment, and she never gave it, right?
Right. She never explained what she said. That she found that there was enough evidence for a prima facie case, but she didn't cite what that evidence. She said clear and convincing evidence. But she never cited what that clear and convincing evidence was.
Was it the pilfering of pens? Was it the interrupting of two conversations? Was it possibly occupying the seats by sitting in them for the purpose for which they were intended? It's hard to tell exactly what particular crime she was referring to.
Right, and then her not allowing Bernard to be severed from the case, I thought was a little ridiculous. I mean, where she cited somebody had come in from, I guess, redevelopment and was afraid to go back to the city council office because you people were sitting there. And I guess Bernard had asked her how she slept the night before, and she took that in the wrong way or something, thinking he was sexually harassing her or something. That's the only thing I can think.
Making her feel guilty inappropriately, perhaps.
But anyway, I mean, I just don't understand why Bernard is still part of this. I don't really understand why Becky's part of the case either. You're the goose that everyone wants to cook, Robert.
I see. Well, let's see what this caller has to say. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Now, I ran an evil video camera. I resent that last remark.
Well, this is Becky Johnson, the second criminal in line we heard from.
Yeah.
Hey, Becky.
No. I mean, if you read the declarations about Bernard and what the response of the woman from the redevelopment agency who said that she dreaded coming to the office after this encounter with Bernard where he asked her how she slept that night before, she clearly understands it's connected to the sleeping ban. And she said that she is not in a position where she can affect policy, and it's not her fault. The plight of the homeless is, certainly terrible, but she shouldn't have to be reminded of it since,
Interesting. It's interesting, Becky. That's exactly what Catherine Acow was talking about, how this was a very important issue and how the homeless, she wasn't criticizing at all people for discussing the homeless issue. And she's sort of playing this liberal schmoozer who wants to assure us all that we have constitutional rights while she's taking them away.
I'm just saying that according to the declaration, she wasn't implying that Bernard had said that. How did you sleep well in a sexual way?
Right. Well, the trouble here is, we have all these, incredibly...
Well, I said that because that would be the only way it would make sense that she was offended by him doing it. That she
took
it...
But it's real clear in her declaration.
She took it the wrong way and thought Bernard was sexually harassing her. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense.
I just find this whole discussion, both in the declarations, in the court, and even in our radio station, we're being led away, and that's the whole point, perhaps, from the real issue, which is civil rights for homeless people, right? I mean, you yourself, I guess you have a show tonight that you're inviting people to listen to or to watch on community television on Channel 27, Becky. It's Club Cruise.
Yeah, that'll be on at 7 o'clock, and everyone can switch off from your show, Robert, and watch mine.
Yeah, yeah.
However, they'll still get you, because this particular show is a show we taped a few weeks ago where you're hosting with Linda LeMaster, the former chair of the Homeless Issues Task Force.
I think Linda and I are having some sparring there, yeah.
Well, that's par for the course for any of us who know the two of you.
Or spar for the course.
But it's a lively show with lots of information and kind of an unhappy outcome there with what the city council chose to do with all those recommendations.
Right, they dumped all the Homeless Issues Task Force declarations, which, according to, we heard from attorney Kate Wells, who said she spoke to Karen Gillette, and Karen Gillette said that she had been approached by Catherine Byers to be involved with this whole process.
Yeah, Catherine asked her to be the staff person, staff liaison for the Homeless Issues Task Force, and she turned her down.
And Catherine Byers revealed that they weren't going to be doing anything with any of these recommendations. It was a way of essentially getting people a chance to vent. This is, we're talking second and third hand information, but a lot of good recommendations, in spite of the fact that I called them the Homeless Issues Task Force, did come out of this task force, and they were all ignored. But hopefully they won't be ignored tonight at 7 o'clock. If you tune in on Channel 27 on community television, that's Club Cruise, from 7 to 7:30. And I would request that anyone who has this and has access to a VCR and can record this for me, do so, because I would like to have a copy of this. Maybe I could even play the audio portion on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
I understand Free Radio has that capability now.
We would hope so. But I have to first figure out which switch to turn on.
Oh, no. Well, that'll be a while.
Not that switch, I guess. Okay, well, listen, thank you. Anything else you want to add, Becky, about about what happened in court today?
I sort of felt it was like, if you looked at any little piece of what we were alleged to have done on any given day, it was not a criminal behavior. It was not something that by itself would constitute harassment at all. And Kathleen Akau was saying, yeah, but if you put all these non-incidents together and have a long string of non-incidents, that's harassment.
Well, the claim she was making...
If you had 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0...
The claim she was making was that incidents that don't appear to be harassment individually taken in isolation, if done continuously over a period of time with the intention of harassing, can in fact constitute harassment. The problem was, Anna Brooks' declarations don't contain any specifics that would allow you to reasonably draw that conclusion about any of the things she says. And indeed, as for the intent to harass, you know, that also is absent. But as was pointed out by attorney David Beauvais, they're very vague allegations. There are some specific incidents, but she draws a few incidents out over a three-week period and attempts to make it appear that it's a continuous pattern without documenting such a pattern. And, of course, that may come up in our evidentiary hearing. Hopefully it will. And that'll be, on March 25th or thereafter, since things seem to get continued in this town.
Well, I think they said it for March 22nd.
22nd. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you for calling in, and keep me advised, and, you know... try to avoid antagonizing Anna Brooks, okay? Apparently, if you do, you don't get to go to City Hall anymore.
Anna, if you're out there,
or is it
I'm
Tim
sorry.
Fitz,
I'm
is
going
it Tim
to try
Fitzmaurice?
To change my evil ways.
You know, it's not Anna Brooks at all. Anna is just a worker there. It's Tim Fitzmaurice, I'm afraid. He's the one who doesn't like us there. He's the one who doesn't like his hypocrisy being exposed. But, you know, he has to be responsible for what he does and doesn't do. So, thank you very much.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
And actually, I believe there is, oops, sorry, folks, a little too loud there. There is an opportunity for those of you who want to call Tim Fitzmaurice to account to come to a Green Party meeting this Saturday, 4 o'clock, at the Loudoun-Nelson Center. About a week or two ago, I had a debate with Nick Whitehead on the phone here. He has some sort of homelessness subcommittee he's investigating, and I believe Nick genuinely does want to change things in this town, make sleeping a legal process, a legal reality for homeless people rather than something that
they have to hide and puts them in a position where they can freeze to death or they can get beaten up or get $54 tickets or get treated like subhuman creatures by the police department or by private citizens simply for doing what everybody has to do. I think Nick is interested in this, but I think, again, the problem is that we've seen the Green Party, you know, mired in for the last 2 years, declining to come up to the mic of the city council and call out the most prominent Green Party member in town, the mayor, Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice, or, as you will, previously the vice mayor for the previous year when he was vice mayor. Scott, you've been going to city council meetings endlessly, and I guess you went to the one on Tuesday. That was one of those off city council meetings, not your usual second and fourth Tuesday. What happened there? Anything of interest?
Well, it was a special meeting basically concerning the water supply. And there was three different components to it. The first was this five-year water use plan that is state mandated. Every 5 years they have to have an update of their water plan. And
non-fluoridated at the moment, but who knows tomorrow.
Right. And so they, you know, have to do this. So that basically the city council just is like, okay, this is the plan. They have to approve it before it gets sent to the state. And then the second component of the meeting was there was this study done by an engineering firm to determine what future supplies the city might be able to get for water. And they had 10 different things that they looked at and eliminated 5 of them. And then the other 5, the...
Let me interrupt you for a minute, Scott, because I remember the last time water came up, it was in this interesting situation where we found that UCSC was asking for a huge expansion of its water resources, right?
Well, they were working with the city to upgrade the water pipes going up to campus from the city's system so that they could... The city's water system could deliver an extra 1 million gallons a day to the campus.
But we found that given their planned growth, that was far more than they needed, right?
Well, their planned growth for students is like almost 3 times what they need to house the students that they plan to expand to. What I see happening is that a lot of the high-tech industries use a tremendous amount of water. Texas Instruments uses the same amount of water as the UC campus does.
Really? That's, of course, the group that helped kill the sleeping ban repeal reforms, the safe sleeping zones, this summer.
So if this campus starts becoming a high-tech research center, like many campuses do, they start doing these alliances with business, and business sets up a research center, all of a sudden this campus may need tremendous quantities of water to do this high-tech research.
What do you mean by high-tech research? What are we talking about? Nuclear weapons? I mean, what do you mean?
Well, no, nuclear weapons is already done by another University of California. You know, this would probably have to be computer chips or something, you know, similar to that.
Producing a lot of waste products?
A lot of tainted water.
And for details on this, of course, you might call Uncle Dennis. I don't know if he has a call-in show or not, but his show follows ours, Earth First, at 8 o'clock tonight on Free Radio Santa Cruz, which is what you're tuned to, 96.3 FM. And our show, in case you tuned in late, is Bathrop's Pierre's Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor. I'm in the studio with Scott Graham. My name is Robert Norse. My phone number is 427-3772. And you're invited to call in and join us. At this meeting you were at on Tuesday, did anybody get arrested, thrown out, tossed to the back of the line, or otherwise mistreated by the city council?
No, what was highly unusual is there wasn't even a cop in the room.
No police officers. That must have been that it wasn't that I wasn't present. That must
right.
have been the reason.
There were no police officers at this meeting whatsoever.
And that is, in fact, unusual, because we noticed, and we noted this actually in the hearing today when we were preparing for it, several of us kind of remarked on the fact that Sergeant Bob Hennig, or Hobo Hunter Hennig, as I used to call him from his 60s expedition, I mean his 90, early 90s expeditions against homeless people, he has become a sort of a standby staple of the city council meetings. He stands off to the right next to the city clerk's station at the city council chambers, and you're not allowed to go directly up and give your little green card to Leslie Cook anymore. You have to give it to Sergeant Bob Hennig because
he's the sergeant of arms now.
He's the sergeant of arms, man. I mean, so we have our own sergeant. I guess we should be proud.
He's the de facto sergeant. You know, if you read the inside cover of the council agendas, they list him as being the de facto. He said the chief of police or his designee are the de facto sergeant of arms of the city council meetings.
Right. Well, so there was no sergeant or there was no police officers. Were there many people in the audience at this meeting?
Mostly city staff.
Uh-huh.
And the staff people for the engineering firms that wrote up the reports.
Any implications of the city council session for poor people in Santa Cruz?
Well, I've heard rumors that there's supposed to be something on the agenda soon. But it's not an action item, it's only a discussion item.
I'm talking about at the Tuesday session with the water. Are we talking about a huge amount of money being spent on water? I mean, I know we focused our searching, pitiless glare of publicity on the police department budget to some extent and showed how there have been huge cost overruns, though apparently everybody at the city council is just blithely ignoring that, as is the city staff. But, you know, what about the water?
That's one thing that's interesting is the water department has been overseeing the building of the police department.
Well, that's why they're all wet down there.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Well, what they were looking at, these five different options for future water supplies.
How would this affect you and me and the guy on the street?
Well, it increased water costs, but the two options that they described in this thing as being the most viable was either a desal plant where they pump in ocean water and then run it through a reverse osmosis filter and get the most of the salt out of it. It doesn't remove all of the salt, though. Or a reclamation plant where they would reclaim water and then use that water on irrigation and also on North Coast farms, and then the city would then get the water that these North Coast farms would have used.
And the effect on your average homeless person would be?
They could get jobs helping build some of these places.
Dig it, man. So
maybe, you know, only a job scraping mud off the road from the trucks going by and stuff.
But mm-hmm. Jobs are always welcome. Speaking of which, here's a little number.
Since this world began, the phrases we have had our share. Let them eat cake and on your bike and more, I do declare. But now the latest thing you hear as you walk down the street, you can't be up to date if you don't call out when you meet. Are you working? No, are you? Are you working? No, are you? Everywhere you go, when you meet a pal, you say, hello, hello. Are you working? No, are you? Three cheers for the red, white and blue. Tell me the old, old story. Are you working? No, are you? Now Jones got wed to Mary Ann, and 12 months after that, something new arrived to liven up the flat. A little bouncing baby boy, when he could hardly speak, looked up at his papa and said in accent rather weak, are you working? No, are you? Are you working? No, are you? You meet a pal, you say, hello, hello. Are you working? No, are you? Three cheers for the red, white and blue. Tell me the old, old story. Are you working? No, are you? about Katie Brown, she ran to town the day she finished school. She couldn't wait to get a job, she knew she was no fool. But day by day, to her dismay, there were no jobs about. And passing by the playground, she could hear the kids all shout, "Are you working? No, are you? Are you working? No, are you? Everywhere you go, when you meet a pal, you say hello, hello. Are you working? No, are you? Each year's full of red, white and blue. Tell me the old, old story. Are you working? No, are you?" Well, back in 1922, when first this song was sung, there wasn't any work about for my old dad and mum. Well, now they sit and listen, and the words, they still are true. What do we say to our kids when they ask of me and you? Are you working? No, are you? Are you working? No, are you? Hello, hello. Are you working? No, are you? 3 cheers for the red, white and blue. Tell me the old, old story. Are you working? No, are you?
Borders on the 1st of February, talking to
Robbie.
Robbie, you said that you had an unusual visit from the police, or perhaps usual.
It was usual, quite. You know, I've been told for a long time how police officers harass people for sleeping in their vehicles. Well, I have a Chinook, and I park it on May Street. Oh, I'm not supposed to say that. I park it.
Forget that, folks.
Forget that. I park it somewhere in town, and yeah, police came by twice and woke me up at odd hours, like at 6 or at 5, and told me to move my vehicle.
Did they say there had been a complaint?
Yes, they said complaint. But I don't know who would complain. I'm such a nice guy.
Now, you are sleeping in your vehicle regularly?
Oh, yes. That's my home.
Now, why is that illegal is what I wonder.
Well, it's illegal because merchants in this town prefer to have the police moving away individuals of certain types to other communities.
That's why we love
borders.
Well,
that's segregation.
Really nice.
The police told me, she said, I'd suggest you move your vehicle out of Santa Cruz.
Really?
Uh-huh.
By what a candid police officer. How many cops stopped you? Was this one police officer?
Well, it was a female officer. She was the first one there, and then all of a sudden, her buddy officer came in a different car, and they both were glaring at me, telling me to get out and move.
Now, what time of night was it?
No, it was actually in the morning. This time, it was at 8:30 in the morning. The time before that, it was at 6 in the morning. They came with a tow truck and towed my vehicle.
How long ago was that?
This was in November.
And did they tell you, were you parked legally or not?
Well, I was parked legally. They red-tagged it, but I assumed I had 3 days to move it. But they came the very next day after they red-tagged it and towed my vehicle away.
So the red tag said you had 72 hours?
Uh-huh. You had 72 hours to move it.
Now, did you reclaim your vehicle?
I reclaimed it. It cost like $150 to get out of pick and pull.
And so for the last 2 months, you've been sleeping without being molested, or have they been ignoring you? Have you been, so we say, using deep cover? What's the story?
I've been trying to imagine a bubble of protection around my vehicle.
Psychic defense.
Right, psychic defense. That's my most recent strategy.
That doesn't work.
They
hired the psychics.
Hand
on that one, man. That's right.
Yeah,
they hire the psychics.
Yeah, right. Look at Evan. He's been here forever. And
he's socially acceptable.
I don't know.
So, the police came. When was this last visit?
Oh, this was about a week ago. Less than a week ago, the police came. I should have known better because I was parked in front of a house that was blaring Christian music out really loud, and I'm supposing they're the ones that called the police.
Had you been parked there for a number of days?
For like 3 days, and they woke me up.
And had anybody actually come to you and said, "We don't want you in front of our house, please move"?
No. The police were the only ones that came.
Did the police say that the people in the house were concerned about your vehicle?
They didn't mention anything about anyone in any houses. They just said, we've got a complaint.
And which section of town was this?
This was over by the Highway 17, or close to that area.
I see. And you've been in your vehicle since you reclaimed it in November without any kind of harassment other than this episode?
Without any molestations.
Now, do you think that this indicates that police have generally backed off, or does it indicate to you that you've hidden well? What's the story?
I've pretty hidden well. For a month of that time, I was in someone's driveway, so I was totally legal in my
Actually, only 3 days per month are you legal in any one driveway.
Really?
Yeah. It's crazy.
That's
shit.
Bullshit.
Yeah, sure is. So did you actually get a ticket? Did they write you a ticket this time?
No, they didn't write me a ticket.
What did they tell you? Get out of town?
Get out of town.
Well, that was very nice of them. And tonight...
They also suggested some places I can park it and camp out the pay.
What do they suggest?
They suggest that place over by Graham Hill Road or something.
Oh, right. That's a state park. I don't know if they're open during the winter, or at least they Does anybody know if the park up Graham Hill Road is open this winter?
February 15th, I believe.
So it's still closed?
I believe it opens the 15th.
Well, you don't have to sleep until the 15th. Just, you know, stay alert for the next couple weeks, and then you can go sleep in the park.
Which park?
Well, it's a state park where you have to pay a fee to get in.
Pay a fee? How much is the fee?
You know, I don't know. It used to be...
It's about $10 a day, I think.
Or maybe $14 a day is the figure that comes to my mind, but I'm not sure. You could be right.
State park is not
I'd like to make a statement.
Yes. Your name, sir?
Camping,
well, give yourself a name.
This is Donkey speaking, and...
go ahead, Donkey.
I just want to...
Just make an ass of yourself, okay?
I'm sorry. I want to say, if anybody from Borders is listening, that we really love you, the homeless, because you're so welcome and sharing. You let us use your bathroom, and there's free coffee. We get to watch a movie, listen to music, and read books. And thank you so much. God bless you all. We love you very much.
So you have a high opinion of Borders and its way it treats homeless people?
I have a high opinion of Borders because it's friendly to all people. It's a corporation, and I think it's a good corporation. Keep on going.
There you have it, folks, an unpaid commercial announcement. Anybody else have any problems or things about the encounters with the police department or the hosts, or have you been treated well recently?
There are really a lot of good police that are just so kind and really understanding people. There are others
that are less understanding and less kind.
Understanding because they're trained that way, and we know that that's your job, and we still love you.
Who says the hate is dead, folks? So anyway, we're going to leave this nest of love and good feeling. Anything else anybody wants to say before I...
I'm good. I got to ask you a question. I'll stay.
Okay. First name is?
Jess.
Jess, you yourself got a camping ticket?
Yes.
And when did this happen?
It was probably about 2 months ago.
And were you in a vehicle or outside of
vehicle? I was in a vehicle.
And what happened?
It was like 7 in the morning, and I actually wasn't even sleeping in the rig. Like, I came down to get some stuff out of it, because I lived up on Beach Hill, and I couldn't park it up there. So I walked down the hill, and I'm getting some stuff out of it, and the cop knocks on it. And I came out, and he's like, he started writing me up his ticket and stuff.
Did he say anything to you before he began writing the ticket?
I don't really remember. He didn't say much.
Because you cannot be given a ticket for... parking a vehicle, unless it's illegally parked. It probably wasn't illegally parked.
Illegal.
You can be given a ticket for sleeping in a vehicle, but you say you weren't sleeping.
Yeah, I wasn't.
So that was a ticket that should be thrown out.
Yeah.
What you need to do is you need to challenge it in court. And the way for folks to do that is first you go to the basement of the courthouse, and you, or the county building actually, and you disqualify Mulligan. Mulligan is the judge, or actually referee is what he's called, that you'd normally have, John Mulligan. He's very bad. You don't want him as your judge. And you sign and say, I swear under penalty of perjury that I believe he is prejudiced. You just sign a statement to that effect. And they move it into another court. And you go to that court, and you plead not guilty. And then you come back in a week after you pled not guilty, and you do a trial. And HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, will be willing to kind of try to advise you.
Uh-huh.
But you have to put in a lot of the energy yourself.
Yeah, that's fine.
It takes about a month, and it involves three different trips. First, to the basement to disqualify Mulligan. Second, to the court to arraign yourself and plead not guilty.
Uh-huh.
And third, to the trial, where you essentially will try to show that there is reasonable doubt that you were asleep at the time.
Right on. That's great.
For people who do have camping tickets or sleeping tickets, because it sounds like that's what it was, he didn't accuse you of having a campsite. He accused you of violating the sleeping ban, it sounds like.
Yeah.
The sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance. It's a $54 fine or 8 hours of community service, and you need, and it's also, of course, a bad law. It's unfair because it...
Yeah, there's like state laws that go directly against that. There's a county law that says if you feel you're unfit to drive, you can pull over anytime, anywhere, as long as it's not an illegal parking spot, and sleep until you feel...
There is a county law that allows for roadside resting.
Yeah, roadside resting.
However, the county law also says that if you inhabit or habitate a vehicle by the side of the road, that is considered criminal. It's not considered roadside resting.
Yes.
So you have to be able to show you're a motorist passing through, or at least establish some reasonable supposition that that's the case. Or that, it kind of goes back and forth with their interpretations, but that's the most recent.
They've added to that? They've amended that or whatever?
Well, that's always, they've always had the roadside resting exception, but they use the word motorist.
Yeah.
And it depends on how the judge interprets it. I mean, you can always, you can argue that...
But isn't there a state law at the DMV that says the same thing as the county law?
I don't know that there is a state law. I've never seen it. You might want to look it up, and if you find it, let me know.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, again, 423-HUF.
Okay.
423-4833. Yeah, go down, if you do, once you go through that process and disqualify Mulligan, call me up and give me your court date, and we can talk.
And all I have to say is I move to disqualify you?
You go to the basement, you say, I'd like to disqualify this referee and put it into another court. And they will then do it. You have to sign a paper saying, I swear, I think he's prejudiced.
Yes.
And you probably do if you believe me.
Yeah.
And that's the process to get rid of referee Mulligan. Important to do if you get any kind of ticket, really. He's just misinforms you about your rights, won't give you an equal hearing, favors the testimony of the police. It's just not a good referee. Could go on about him all day, but I won't. It's night. And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathrop Spears Broadsides, and we're going on for another hour. And who knows how long after. Actually, Uncle Dennis will come in and cut us short at 8 o'clock. So if you want to call in, you better call in now, 427-3772, 427-3772. You're listening to Street Interviews, mostly around things like the sleeping ban, the law that criminalizes homeless people at night. It's interesting. A lot of organizations that are supposedly hefty in this town, such as SCAN, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, CAB, CalPERG, the Green Party, the Peace and Freedom Party, all these groups have come out against the sleeping sections of the camping ordinance, the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance. And yet, the city council, which supposedly is progressive heavy, 5-2 or 6-1, depending on how you look at it, if you consider Kennedy a progressive, is doing nothing about this. Now, it's interesting that several years ago, the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women also came out against the sleeping ban. And about a week ago, there was testimony at the last meeting of the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women, which mentioned the sleeping ban and how women are treated. And I hope that at the last meeting, which was actually yesterday, I believe, that at least one commissioner brought up the issue of the sleeping ban, because it has been voted by the previous commission as a bad law, one that city council should change. Let's hear a little of Roxana Quistapache and Sherry Connable addressing the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women.
That here
is Roxana Quistapache.
Aquistapache.
This is a good time to remind folks, since we are live on TV, to talk into your mics. Thank you.
We are not live on TV, in case you had forgotten.
Good evening. I was the one who wised off and said, just say the first name. I thought you were at my knee. And sometimes people just stare and stare at it like, oh, no. So. Hi. In some ways, I don't know where to start, but I have to start. So I'm just going to tell you that one of my big concerns, I've been a homeless activist for a while, but I run a free service called Independent Advocacy Services because I spent a year as the advocate for Santa Cruz County foster parents. And I found that so many people are homeless as a result of their families being split up. When you have a child that, or three children in foster care, or even one difficult child, one child in the teen years can cost the county $5,000 a month. Now, you could have someone go live in with that family and teach them parenting skills for that. So, mothers who lose their children often lose them in error, or who complete their court plan as requested and still don't get their children back, often end up homeless, often end up on the streets and subject to street violence, to rape and violence. It's a vicious circle and it's all tied in. When your child is taken away at that very first hearing, you are not, which happens about 3 days after they're taken, you're not allowed to say one thing in your behalf. And you are not allowed to bring in the people that really know you. So I want to give you an example of how you can lose your child. Let's just say your boyfriend's angry with you. You're going to move to Hawaii. So he calls 911 and tells them that you're suicidal. The police come and they determine to 5150 you on this person's word. Now, you're told not to worry. If you cooperate, you know, and you're let go right away, nothing's going to happen to your child. The child's going to be returned to you right away. I forget, by law, it's 24 hours the doctor has to see you, something like that, 20 hours. So you have a doctor who's covering for three doctors, and he does not get to see you for 36 hours. It's too late. Your child is scheduled for a foster care hearing. Now, what if even though the doctor let you go like that, the medical report is not available? So there you go. You're in front of the court, and a two-month investigation is suggested by CPS, and the child is to stay in foster care with words like, this person could be suicidal, could murder herself and her child. There's no proof, there's nothing. And when the judge says, what's your proof? Then county council says, well, if it happens, judge, let it be on your head. Do you think that mom's going to get her kid back that day? No. And that child, no matter what happens, no matter how erroneous that report is, that child will stay in the system for at least a year. Even if returned to the mother, the child will stay first for 6 months and usually for another 6 months with the family being watched. But most often kept in foster care. This is not a politically correct agenda that I'm bringing in front of you, okay? Associations are afraid to talk. I mean, everybody has a stake in the income they get, all the different parts that they play in the system. But unless there's acknowledgement for how far afield this has gone, I don't really think any change can be made. And for me, the services that I provide are direct, but I also am in touch with Gray Davis, with his wife who's interested. I am dead serious about this problem. Now, the other way you can break up families in the CPS system is you can break up a foster family. You can break them up by one child who either wants out or whatever. Now, I'm not saying there aren't some just accusations. Don't get me wrong. I'm just talking about the unjust ones, of accusing the foster parents of wrongdoing. And they can have, when even law enforcement has determined that there is no reason to bring charges against this family, they can have had their foster children and their own biological children removed, nursing babies, removed from them, simply because this agency has so much power. And what happens to the children? The third problem is, what happens to the children where these homes are broken up quickly without evidence or whatever?
Because I was a foster parent for many years, I'm an adoptive parent, I've served as an advocate, I can tell you that it doesn't go well. A little boy that I know who went to church every Sunday with his foster parent, when his home was just broken apart with very little provocation, within 2 months was living in Watsonville, jumped by a gang, does not go to school anymore, a 12-year-old boy. There's a young lady whose home was recently broken up. They really felt, the teens that were in this home, that this was the last home they would have to go to, they would have to be in. One of the girls is currently, she's 15, is now sexually active without birth control. And there's, you know, we talk about violence. It all comes from anger. And there's a lot of anger in this system that's generated. The parents, the children, even foster parents. Because things go great while you're a foster parent in favor with the county. Things go really badly after that, no matter what you did before. So foster children, both male and female, have a high rate of suicide and an even hot phenomenal rate of they live homeless without really proper education. I just met a woman who has lived in, she went into the foster care system at 10. She was adopted at 15. But in the years intervening, she was in 19 foster homes. Now, what do you think that does for you? And she needs constant mental health services. These kids are subject to rape, street violence, hunger, and lifelong poverty. Not to mention failure to bond, which is really serious. And there's not lawyers available. The public defenders who defend these women, if you're in a county where, this is saying stop. Do I have 5 minutes or am I up?
I'm saying you can't
stop. Already?
Yeah,
no. I blabbed 5 minutes already? Okay, well anyway, lawyers aren't available that, you know, you need money to get a lawyer. And this is not our local DA, this is not their highest priority. So anything that you could do that would help fund services that, you know, give them what they need, the support that they need to get around something that may be very unjust. I guess I'm just going to close because I have a lot more to say, but thank you for listening. I appreciate it. You know about Clinton's new law, you know, that the state gets $600 for every child it adopts out now. There's incentive for adoption. California earned $3.9 million this way last year.
You're listening to some selections from the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women's public hearing of about a week ago, which touched on a number of homeless issues, which is why I found it of interest. Roxana Kistapache just spoke, a very eloquent activist, previously from the Beach Flats, still concerned with the sleeping ban, shelter issues, and the rights of poor people.
Hello. I put together a little bit to say. I'm a family therapist and I work with child abuse, post-traumatic stress, and what I would call social trauma. I was raised experiencing physical and sexual abuse, and I was raised in a military environment. The wonderful Buddhist monk whose name is Thich Nhat Hanh had an expression that I heard once, that anything that isn't peace and joy is violence. We have our work cut out for us, since that is very most probably the case. I would add that anything that isn't peace and joy is abuse. I'm working currently with a group of so-called mainstream citizens concerned about homelessness. We have prepared a letter for the City Council, which I would like to read you briefly, but I see homelessness itself and the way it is criminalized by authorities to be neither peaceful nor joyous and extraordinarily violent toward women. I know that the percentage of women has increased, of homeless people has increased from 30% to 42% over, I believe it's a 10-year period, of the total number of homelessness, 42%. I totally agree with the person named Jeremy who spoke with the Survivor Healing Center that a child's sense or anyone's sense that abuse is not justified when it's applied to that person makes all the difference in the process of proceeding to be an abuser or not proceeding to be an abuser. Someone who knows that it has been wrongly done to them will not proceed. And I would like to quickly read that letter to you. We urge that the Santa Cruz City Council, as our political representatives, refocus attention on the condition of the many homeless people in our community. Given the documented housing shortage, we believe that the city ordinance criminalizing homeless people when they sleep outside or in vehicles is inhumane and may be unconstitutional. P.S. I have no doubt that it's unconstitutional, and there's plenty of court proceedings to support that. We firmly request that the City Council deal constructively and soon with this pressing need for just treatment. We are united in affirming support for the Council's finding a creative, compassionate, comprehensive, and permanent solution. And P.S., as many of them committed to do during the candidacy and the running for City Council period. We urge you to address our concerns and to publicize the Council's intended hearings and actions. Many of us are willing to work with you and have provided numbers or email for you to contact us on this petition, which I will put, with your permission, I would like to put on back tables, if you will. Thank you, Pat. And finally, I totally commend and appreciate your presence here yearly. And I would like to suggest that your names be published on some of the literature, because I can't read them from back there. And I really appreciate your being here, every one of you.
Thank you.
And that was Lydia Blanchard, who was working with the Homeless Working Group, the SCAN Housing and Homelessness Committee, before SCAN dissolved it in that famous October 4th massacre held in a private home under the auspices of Sandy Brown and Bernice Belton. I guess that was immediately followed by the rigged election at the SCAN headquarters. And, of course, in the police station, that's right. SCAN held its meeting, appropriately enough, in the police station. So we've had some hard knocks. If SCAN isn't then rigging its elections, the Superior Court judge is ruling the Constitution doesn't apply to City Hall in Santa Cruz, and or the police department is deciding to gather lots more shekels and buckaroonies for cops to police bicyclists while it's allowing motorists to run over bicyclists and then wander off on their own without any kind of charges or arrest. In the studio with me is Scott Graham, still, believe it or not. And Scott, you've been following the bicycle situation. There was, of course, a grant that was being proposed for three cops. And initially the feds would sweeten the deal by paying for it, but within 2 or 3 years, it would be us who'd be paying for it, and we'd have to pay for it or we'd lose federal funding. And so you bet your butt we'd continue to pay for it. On the air last week, we had a writer for the Metro Santa Cruz who actually uncovered a lot of this stuff in a long story, talking about the hit and run of Sean Duncan. You've been trying to, the bicyclists were motivated to come rolling in and tell Tim Fitzmaurice that they wanted some language put into that grant that would guarantee bicyclists some power and hold motorists accountable for their behavior, maybe set up even, God forbid, a second set of rules for bicyclists so that there was some sort of at least investigation of the European model that you proposed on the air last time. What's happened?
Well, so far, the police had till the end of January to submit the grant, so they had to get it all back together. After the meeting on Monday, they had like less than a week or so to get it together. And
I thought it was January 31st.
January 31st, right.
Okay, because we're now at February 8th.
Right.
So the meeting on Monday was 2 days before January 31st.
Oh, okay. So it was, but anyway, the way what happened was at that meeting, the bicyclists had that were there, plus the ones that had written comments and emailed them to the police or to the Public Works or to the mayor, were very concerned about this grant and its intentions, because even though the police at the city council meeting and at this meeting said that they were intending to, you know, enforce laws against motor vehicle operators, cars and motorcycles, but basically it wasn't in the language of the grant, and no one really believed that, you know, unless it was in there, that that's what would happen. So that was actually one thing that did get changed into the final edition, is that there is now language that they will go after automobiles and motorcycles that are endangering bicycles. So, I mean, that's a good thing. One of the other things that was changed was that originally they had identified who would be getting a large portion of this grant. It's about $140,000. To put on classes at the various elementary and middle schools around town. And they had identified this group, I believe, out of Sacramento called Safe Moves that was going to originally be contracted to do this. And now they left it open that they're going to do an RFP, a request for proposals, once they get the grant to determine who will in fact do this. So that leaves it open for local bicycle advocates to actually get an approved program together before the time and possibly get this contract, so it'll be a local thing. Another change that was made was that the police were going to give away bicycle helmets to kids underage, but a number of the bicyclists said, well, why not also include giving away bike lights, because that's an infraction a lot of bicycle riders get, is that they get tickets for not having bike lights at night, especially on the mall downtown, because that's where most people get bicycle tickets. And so that got included in the grant, that they will also be giving away bike lights. So, you know, that'll give people a chance. You'll get a free bike light, but then if they catch you again without your light on, then, you know, you could get a ticket. There was
all this was written into the grant.
This was all written into the grant. The couple of things that didn't change were the two police officers.
Are the bicyclists asked for?
The bicyclists.
I thought it was three police officers.
Well, there's one sworn officer and two CSOs.
Community service officers.
And so the bicyclists were really wondering, you know, why, what's the need for these people? And the police were saying, well, we'll have them trained as traffic investigators, so they'll go to the scenes of accidents and then relieve the duty officers so they can go off and do their other duties instead of hanging around taking these accident reports.
So, or not taking them, as was the case with Sean Duncan. Apparently, the report came back from Sarah Phelan, who saw the final police report. And it had an additional paragraph and I think one or two additional witnesses, but essentially very few of the people who testified that the motorist was at fault, acting in a reckless and angry and dangerous fashion in that January 20th motorist hits bicyclist at the anti-Bush demonstration.
Because a number of the bicyclists were concerned about adding additional officers as part of this grant. They thought the money could be better spent to actually make the roadway safer for bicyclists. You could take that $250,000 that's going to go towards these salaries for 2 years and actually make improvements to the bike lanes that would make them safer. I mean, there's many places where even though there's a bike lane, the road's so messed up, you have to go out into the road to go around whatever's wrong with the bike lane. And that's not safe. And so they can make
it. You're speaking as a bicyclist yourself.
Right. And so it's like there's a lot of things that can be done there. The other thing bicyclists wanted was that in this grant, the police department's going to get a new motorcycle for $27,000, completely equipped. And the bicyclists thought that it would be a good idea to get bicycles instead of a motorcycle. They could get 10 or 12 fully equipped police bicycles, you know, some of them even electrified. And the one thing about having the cops on bikes, even though they're sneakier and can get around better, is that from a bicyclist perspective, if they're out there on their bikes, all of a sudden they're going to realize what it takes to deal with traffic from a bicyclist perspective. And so then when they're out there in their cars patrolling, they're going to realize when the car in front of them is exhibiting behavior that's a danger to bicycles.
It'll be the other way around, too. When the general public sees cops on bikes, they might be less prone to run them off the road.
Right, or less prone to drive their cars in the bike lanes and things.
Exactly. Now, what's your final assessment? I was very gloomy when I heard, you know, Fitzmaurice's kind of what seemed to me like schmoozing reassurances to the bicyclists at a council meeting of, I guess, a Tuesday before last. And I heard about that thing about a week ago, Monday, how he had another schmoozing session at the ABC room and, you know, told the bicyclists, oh, everything will be okay when the grant goes in on Wednesday. And then the grant was delayed. We never saw it on the internet. We didn't know what it was all about. Now you're telling us that the bicyclists have gotten bike lights as well as helmets, or instead of helmets?
Well, the helmets were part of the original grant. It's just that they're getting bike lights
as well.
As well, yeah.
An RFP instead of a sole source provider for this a safety program, which may let in the locals.
Right, and also what they also got was more sort of public hearings with the police around bicycle issues. So the police are asking for more money than the original draft grant to hold public hearings around bicycle issues.
Well, what's your assessment of this? I mean, certainly those last three things don't sound bad, but again, the key issue of the extra cops and instead of improvements to the roads, you know, you get more money for the cops, and also motorcycle instead of bike sounds like a big chunk of the issue being essentially turned down. How do the bicyclists fare in this, by your assessment?
Well, the key issue to me as a bicyclist was the fact that they were stipulating in the grant that they were going to enforce safety laws against bicyclists and pedestrians, but they didn't say anything about automobiles, and that got included in the grant language.
That was a significant addition.
The big loss was that so much of the money is going towards new police salaries and a motorcycle. That's the biggest loss.
Now, does this kind of change your perception of Fitzmaurice? Do you feel that he was a hard negotiator with the police department? Did he get these changes? Why, or was it simply the pressure of the bicycle group? I thought that Fitzmaurice might shine on that pressure, or just leave it up to Belcher, the police chief. What has your assessment of Fitzmaurice changed in this regard?
Well, it's basically my assessment of Chief Belcher and Sergeant Bailey changed. The fact that they were even willing to meet with everybody, I thought, was a big step forward.
We have a call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi.
Hi.
¿Habla español?
Poquito.
Un poco. Poquito.
Hablemos de los problemas de bicicletistas, ¿cómo se llama?
Las bicicletas.
We're talking about the problems of bicyclists, yeah.
Yeah, la moto. But what is police department, el Salan Cruz? What police department? Why?
¿Qué dice?
Que por qué están hablando de los policías de que va a haber motos nuevos o qué?
Mi problema es mi español es muy pequeño. My problem is my Spanish is small and muy despacio, very slow too.
Yeah.
So I discúlpeme, señor. You're asking a question about the police, la policía.
Yeah.
Digo otra vez. Say it again.
Va a haber motos nuevos del condado de Santa Cruz.
You're using Tú tienes palabras que no puedo entender. No sabe qué son las palabras. You're using words I don't understand.
For what? ¿A motos?
¿A motos? ¿Qué cosa es esto? ¿Automóvil?
automobile or...
So you're asking a question about automobiles.
Yes.
And what is it again?
They want a police, they want a patrulla.
Patrol?
Patrol, yeah. One go on. ¿Por qué está hablando de los policías?
Why are we talking about the police?
Yeah.
Porque la policía... un pregunta de cuánto para pagar la policía para, ¿cómo se dice?, dar citaciones contra los biciclistas.
Sí.
Y es una cuestión porque hay una... I'm explaining to the caller why we're talking about what we're talking about. You know, what I should do... Es necesario hablar otra vez de esta cosa porque no puedo traducir todo que yo he hablado. I can't translate everything I've said into Spanish. First of all, my Spanish isn't that good.
Yeah, yeah.
And
the one is the police, the one is, I don't know, ¿por qué va a haber más policías?
Why should we have more police? Is that what you're saying? Yeah, I don't think we should have more police. I think we should have police better trained, better controlled by the community.
Yeah.
And I wish I spoke better Spanish.
Yeah, but we want to start más patrulla nuevos y van a poner más carros nuevos más años más.
Cada año más caro para la policía? Or?
Sí.
Yeah, each year it gets more expensive for the cops. I mean, more expensive to have. And that's true. And that's one of the questions I've been raising. ¿Por qué 5 millones? Why 5 millones y 7 millones más para una estación nueva para la policía?
Sí.
Why a $7 million cost overrun on a $5 million police station for the new police station?
Yeah.
Caller, let me leave you because I'm getting...